Hello everyone and welcome to the Writers Book Club podcast. I'm Michelle Barakoff and each month I take a deep dive with an author into the writing craft and process behind one of their books. Have you ever read a novel and thought to yourself, how on earth did the author pull that off? That's exactly what crossed my mind when I read The Search Party by Hannah Richel. I know many of you are huge fans of Hannah. She's a beautiful writer and her talent is fully on display again with this novel, her fifth novel, The Search Party. But this one's a little bit of a departure for her. Hannah's novels always have had a mystery element to them, but with this novel, she's taken it up a notch. It's not a police procedural, but the police investigation does play an important part in how the novel is structured, and it's really clever. And of course, at the heart of the novel, as with all of Hannah's novels, are the relationships, this time with a focus on friendships. Hannah and I had the most wonderful chat. I think you're going to get so much out of this. She talked about how she wrangled the 8 points of view. Yes, 8. How she restructured the novel when she realized it wasn't hooky enough. She talked about her editing process, how she managed the dual timeline, and how she incorporated backstory and what she did to make sure that the reveals were in the best place. Because that's not always easy to know, is it? And I don't think I've ever talked to a writer about writing retreats before, but Hannah and I went there. She talked about how she does it, where she goes, why she goes. Now, I know many of you, like me, have the same kind of life constraints that Hannah does. Partner, kids, work. So getting away on a retreat can be really challenging. So have a listen out for that. Okay, let me tell you about The Search Party. Max and Annie Kingsley have left the London rat race to set up a glamping site in the wilds of Cornwall. They invite old university friends, TV star Dominic, doctor and new mum Kira, and free-spirited Jim and Suze and their children for a trial weekend, but the reunion quickly veers off course. First, there's the incident around the campfire on the first night. The following afternoon, a storm quickly develops off the rugged north coast. When one of their group goes missing, all hell breaks loose. And as the winds batter the bell tents, emotions run high and tensions mount for all the characters. Who is lying in hospital, who has gone missing, and who is the body on the beach below the cliffs? Gripping, cleverly structured, and brimming with secrets and lies, this is a masterclass in narrative tension and a chilling exploration of the ways in which aspiration and anxiety collide. It will keep you guessing until the last page. That is such a great summation of the book. I really was guessing until the last page. I had no idea who the body on the beach below the cliffs was, but I guessed everybody except who it actually was. So well played, Hannah. All right, let me tell you a little bit about Hannah before we dive into the interview. Hannah Richel was born in Kent and spent her childhood years in Buckinghamshire and Canada. After graduating from the University of Nottingham, she worked in the book publishing and film industries in both London and Sydney. Hannah is a dual citizen of Great Britain and Australia and currently lives in the southwest of England with her family. She's the author of international bestsellers Secrets of the Tides, The Shadow Year, The Peacock Summer, The River Home, and now The Search Party. Her work has been translated into 21 languages. Wow, that's phenomenal. Hannah is also a judge for the Richel Prize for Emerging Writers, which was set up in memory of her late husband, Matt. Actually, Hannah and I had a good chat about the Richel Prize, so have a listen out for that. Please enjoy my chat with the wonderful Hannah Richel. Hannah, welcome to the Writers Book Club podcast. It's such a delight to have you on.
Oh, thank you, Michelle. I'm so happy to be talking to you. Really excited about this.
And congratulations on The Search Party. It is such an accomplished novel, so gripping. I remember finishing it and my first feeling was, God, that was satisfying. And then my second thought was, how on earth did she pull that off? All those points of view and oh my gosh, it's so good.
I think I probably had the same thought too, actually, at certain points. When I found out it was going to be published, I was probably thinking, wow, how on earth did I pull that off?
So it's a slight departure for you, this novel, Hannah, isn't it? I mean, even though all of your novels have a bit of a mystery element to them, this one has a bit more of a crime feel to it, or because you've got the police presence without it being a police procedural per se. But yes. It was still very character driven. It was still very much a Hannah Richel novel. Was that a deliberate choice or did it evolve that way with the sort of the mystery and the crime element?
Yeah, it's interesting because I don't think I set out initially to write a crime thriller, which is where the publisher have placed it in the sort of the market as a whole. I was trying to write a character-driven story about a group of friends who experience a really terrible weekend. And so the thriller aspect wasn't the first thing that came to mind really when I was writing. I think what happened was I was very aware that my fourth novel, The River Home, had come out during lockdown. I know a lot of writers had books coming out at that time, and it did okay, but it sort of faded away quite quickly. And as any writer knows, you know, it's heartbreaking when you put a novel out there and you don't feel it's quite met its readership. And, you know, it happens all the time. And over the course of a writing career, it is going to happen. But that was the book where I sort of lost a little bit of heart, I think, at the end of it and thought, how do I get my mojo back? You know, I'm still really proud of The River Home. And I think it says a lot about what I wanted to say at that time in my life. But I was aware that I was just trying to kind of ramp up a little bit about what I was doing. And I've always loved to play with suspense, and I've always loved to have a bit of a puzzle in my novels. And I've always wanted it to be something that the reader's trying to solve. The story is something that the reader's trying to solve as they go along. And that's been from the sort of very first novel that I wrote. But this book sort of took on its own life as I started writing, and it became very apparent about a third of the way into the writing that a good way to ramp up the tension would be to introduce a police investigation, which is something I haven't done before. So I was really quite scared to go into that world because I don't have a police background. Yeah. I've never committed a crime, thank goodness. So I knew it was going to involve a fair bit of, you know, learning new ways of writing, new characters, literally procedure that had to go into the novel. But I wanted to do that because I realized that that would be a great way, first of all, to structure the book, and secondly, to ramp up the tension, which I hoped would then hook in the reader and see them going through right to the very end of the story. So it was kind of a calculated decision, actually, in the end. But I'm glad I took it because actually it came very naturally. And other than doing a bit of research into, you know, the way police, the organisation is structured and who would actually be at a crime scene and who would be talking to the characters and what does that look like and what sort of questions are they asking. And you can learn a lot of that from reading crime fiction, but also from, you know, the internet. Then it was quite straightforward, actually, to then restructure the book with this investigation running through it. And that, for me, was a lot of fun because it felt like a new space to be writing and playing in.
I love how you say it just came naturally. That must just have been heaven, that feeling of it just kind of flowing.
It's rare, isn't it, when you get the solution like that. And I think those are the moments that as writers we sort of live for, when things slot into place or you find the solution to a problem that's been bugging you for weeks, or you know something's not quite right. And in this case, it was the structure. I was telling the story initially in quite a straightforward way because I wanted it to be a straightforward book for me as a writer. I think I was being a bit lazy, to be honest. And then I realized that it wasn't working. It wasn't going to be, for the space I write in, it wasn't going to be hooky enough. It was a great moment when I suddenly pieced together how to structure it.
Absolute heaven, that feeling. Tell us about the genesis of The Search Party, Hannah. How did the idea for the novel come to you? Was it about the friends? I know a lot of times your novels start with setting, but was it the setting or that sort of concept of the friends coming together?
I think it was one of those lovely moments where two things meshed together at once. And I had written previously in my past four books generally about families and family dynamics, particularly between mothers and daughters, was sort of where I've generally written before. So the idea of writing about friendship was appealing to me, and particularly writing about older friendships, so people who've known each other for a space of 20 years, because to me that was the interesting dynamic really between them as to how have these people changed over the course of 20 years. What has that done to their friendships? And what are their expectations of each other as they come back together for this chaotic reunion, you know, because when we do catch up with old friends, we almost expect everyone to be as we left them. And it can be a shock when people have changed, whether it's through their marriages or through having children, their careers, whether they've been successful or failures. And you have to meet people where you find them. But we're all, I think, it's quite hard to do that sometimes, yeah, because we want them to be the same person that they were 5 years ago. And I think the other interesting dynamic with the idea of friendship and looking at this particular group of friends was bringing the kids in as well, because anyone who's hung out with a big group of friends and kids will instantly know that, you know, there can be interesting dynamics going on in that group, and people parent in really different ways, and that can bring its own set of tensions to a social setting. So for me, it was the friendship idea that was the sort of first point that was sort of playing in my mind, really, as I started to think about what sort of book I was going to write after The River Home. And then that meshed really beautifully with Cornwall, which was a place that I was dreaming about visiting during lockdown, which is when I started writing this novel. And I was sitting in a sort of small landlocked English town, very pretty, but, you know, we weren't allowed very far past our front doors. And I was dreaming about big skies and crashing waves and walking along windswept beaches. And I was craving that. And I think I was harking back to my time, you know, my decade or so living in Sydney when we were so close to the coast. And I was really missing that. So my head was in Cornwall and my head was thinking about friendship and bringing a group of friends back together. And fortuitously, I had taken a glamping holiday with some friends about 2 or 3 years before I started writing this book. And so that was the seed, I think, yeah, when I remembered that holiday. And I just thought that I don't think anyone's written a glamping novel before. And yeah, maybe this is my book. So that started it off. And actually, once I had those things locked in, it did fall together in quite a, not an easy way. It certainly wasn't an easy book to write, but it felt visual in my head. And I like to be able to see things in my mind's eye as I'm writing them. And then I hope that translates into what comes across on the page.
Yeah, I've spent some time in Cornwall and I can picture it perfectly, the big skies, and that there's something ancient about that land as well. That feeling too of turning your back on the ocean, I've had that before as well, having now lived in Sydney for 25 years. Whenever I go to my hometown of Melbourne, I feel like I'm turning my back on the ocean. It's a really strange feeling, yeah, isn't it?
It is. And I feel very deeply connected to the ocean. And, you know, I'm actually not a massive swimmer and I'm a complete softy when it comes to cold water, but I love to be by the ocean. Yeah. And I don't think I quite understood when I stepped away and I moved back to the UK, how much it had sort of captured my heart, really. And so I crave it now. And yeah, it's a place that I find a lot of kind of peace. And, you know, it's just, I like to go there and I like to sort of lose myself, you know, sitting on a cliff, looking out and thinking. And so, yeah, I do crave it. But yes, turning your back on it, I think it's something I had to do. But it means that I now need to sort of seek out my connection as and when I can.
Yeah. I urge listeners to follow Hannah on Instagram because you're a very talented photographer, I must say. You really capture landscape so beautifully.
Thank you. Well, I just snap on my iPhone, but I like taking pictures. And I've thought, actually, if I wasn't a writer now, maybe I'd retrain and become a photographer because, yeah, I find it actually quite inspiring for my writing to, you know, take pictures and then sort of understand the details that I'm focusing in on. Because I think as a writer, that's what you do in a scene. You have to pick the details that you want to zoom in on.
Yes, that's so true. You've got a really beautiful eye for composition, I think, as well. And so that makes perfect sense to me. So speaking of settings, let's go to setting because it is such an integral part of your novels. You're particularly good at houses. Your first novel had that magnificent house on the coast. I still want one of those painted rooms from Cloudsley, that magnificent painted room. Penelope Janu, the writer, asks, how important was this particular setting in terms of creating the characters and plotting the crime? Which I thought was such an interesting question from Penny, because sometimes setting is one of the characters, isn't it? And sometimes it can lend itself really beautifully to the plot itself.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you, Penny. For each of my novels, setting has been absolutely inherent to the story and often drives the story. And I enjoy books where setting, landscape, or a big house is as much a character in the book as the people moving through them. So I think that's what attracted me in the very, very beginning to creating Clifftops as the house in Secrets of the Tides, yes, for example. And it became this sort of living thing in my head. And so from that point on, I've always zoned in on setting and wanted it to feel like a character within the book. So within the search party, it's a little different because there's no building as such. There's no house for the characters to move through. Whereas I think I'm right in saying that all my previous books, there's always a central building.
Yes, there's the cottage, isn't there, in the Shadow Year?
Yes, and then there's crumbling Cloudsley in the Peacock in Summer, and the River Home is a farmhouse on a Somerset riverbank. Yes. So there's always been a house. So this was quite liberating because I'm throwing the characters into the elements. All they've got for protection are these flimsy bell tents. There is a farmhouse up on a clifftop, which does feature briefly, but it was essential, I think, for this story, for the characters to be set free and absolutely stripped back from any kind of protection or their devices, anything that was going to offer them some kind of parameters or civilization.
Almost like that closed room type of,
yes, exactly,
what they call in crime novels, that sort of closed room thing.
Exactly. I hadn't actually thought of it. I'd like to say, yes, I planned it as a locked room mystery, as they call
locked
it.
Locked room, thank you.
Yes, but I wasn't that clever. So it was only afterwards that I think somebody said, oh, yes, you know, you've locked them away on the peninsula. And I suddenly realised what I'd done. So I can't take credit for that. I wish I could.
Well, subconsciously you can, Hannah. We're just going to pay it.
Okay. Subconsciously, I locked them on the peninsula. In an Agatha Christie vibe. And that was fun. And actually, the setting did inform the plot, because after lockdown lifted and I was still in the throes of writing this novel, I took a research trip down to the area near St. Ives and the area where there's a lot of old tin mines up on the cliffs and there's old ruins sort of strewn across this landscape. And I got to stand on the cliffs and I got to look around and I got to see the warning signs about, you know, crumbling cliffs and mine shafts and all sorts of things that were there in the landscape, just waiting to sort of be dropped into this novel. And it kind of then helped a lot of the crucial plot points that then happen, which create a lot of the drama in the story. So absolutely, the setting informed the plot. And I think the characters, because I wanted the characters at the end of the book to have each gone through, to have gone on a journey and to have transformed in some way, whether it be for the better or possibly for the worse.
I loved the tents as well. Like, you could really picture those. And, you know, if you want to get all symbolic, the fact that they were quite exposed to, you know, to the weather, and the weather played a role as well, because that created that separation. And so beautifully described, like I could visualize everything. And there's a map at the start. Not everybody gets a map, Hannah. Like, the map at the start is gorgeous. Is that something that you get now that this is your fifth novel? They say you're allowed to have a map now in your book.
I was so lucky, because I love a book with a map. And as you say, I've never had a map before. And it was the publisher in the UK, I think. She said, you know, it would be quite fun to have a map. Yes. And I said, well, funny that, actually, because I drew myself a map when I was writing the novel because I needed to be able to track where yes. all these characters, because there's a lot of characters, I needed to track where they were going and how things pieced together and was it actually physically working. You know, I didn't want a reader to be questioning, you know, the layout of the landscape and whether it actually was physically possible for the story to happen. And so I'd had to draw this map myself, and it even had the most dreadful looking little wonky cows in a field. And I then had to embarrassingly send my map to my publisher with a big caveat saying, I'm really sorry, I can't draw cows. And they sent it off to a very talented illustrator who turned it into the beautiful thing that you see at the front of the book. Yes. So I was very lucky that they didn't want to run with mine because that would have been mortifying. Same with the cast list, actually. I love books. When I was a teenager, I used to inhale Jilly Cooper's books, which always had a cast list. So when they, I think they suggested the cast list as, I had the cast list at the front when I sent it off. But they wanted to keep that, which again, you know, was for me, that was great because I love a book with a map and a cast list.
Yeah. It's always nice to be able to go back and see where everybody fits, especially if you're having a break. I mean, I couldn't put this down, so I had all the characters pretty straight in my head. But if I had have had, you know, a week break or had to put it down for whatever reason, I could always go back and you could see the cast list. It's a brilliant idea. I love that. Okay, so this brings us to the structure, Hannah. Let's talk about those 8 points of view. Eight. Oh my gosh. How did that evolve and how did you manage? I'm just trying to figure out how you did it mentally, but also technically. Are we talking whiteboards, post-it notes, Scrivener? How? Just tell me all the secrets about these 8 points of view.
So to begin with, I was very naive, and in my head, I developed these different family groups that were going to be attending this reunion weekend. And I divided them up and I worked out who they were generally, because I often discover as I'm writing, I write my way into my characters. So it was just generalized ideas of who these families and these characters were and the very, very basic plot. And I get too excited. So then I was thinking, right, I've got enough. I'm going to jump in and I'm going to start writing. And it might amuse you to know that I actually had another family originally that were going to be on the weekend. So there were actually going to be 5 families in my head, which looking back now, I just think, what was I thinking?
Can I just quickly ask, just because I'm curious, was it a woman and a man? And
it was a man and a woman, and they were very sporty. They turned up with their fancy bikes and their Lycra, and they were going to be, you know, the kind of really sporty bunch within the group. And he was going to be off cycling madly. And
right.
In the end, they were just too much. I just didn't need another family. And I was able to take some of the personality traits that I wanted from that family and put them into the 4 existing families. So actually, even before it got to a publisher, I had got rid of them a long time before. But yes, 8 points of view, and it was a lot. And I've never written a book with that many points of view before, but I wanted them each to have a voice. Not everybody has a voice, actually. Not everybody gets their own chapters.
No.
But it felt important that certain scenes were seen through certain eyes, because I wanted there to be that element of what's the truth and what is someone's truth versus someone else's truth, and who knows what and who doesn't know other crucial pieces of information, because that play in a thriller or crime novel or a mystery novel is what I think makes it really intriguing. And that's always something that I've enjoyed playing with in my previous novels, which is, you know, who's telling their story and how does their story mesh with someone else's story. So if you think about a family, everyone's got their own point of view. It's one family story, but everybody's got their own story within that family. So this was like that, but exploded in terms of the number of characters and their shared history and bringing it all back together for one weekend. And the way I did it was the wrong way, which was just to write and write and write until I got myself into a massive mess. And then I had to break out an Excel spreadsheet where I wrote down the characters and timelines. And I'm not very good with Scrivener. I have tried Scrivener, but I don't get on terribly well with it. So I tend now to break my Word documents into headings, which sit on a navigation grid to the side of my Word document. So I can bounce between the headings, and the headings are often just the character name and the day and the time. And
that's basically how Scrivener works.
Yes. So then I can navigate through my Word document much more easily. But I've only just recently discovered that on this book. So it's saving me a lot of time. And I wish I'd known it a lot sooner in my writing career. but yeah, then it's just following my nose. I just let them tell the story. And I work out as I get to the end of one scene, what's the next scene and who do we need to see it from? And that's probably not the smartest way to do it, because I often then have to go back and segue in new things or unpick certain details. But it's the way I do it. It's the way I've always done it. And I just sort of let it come out on the page and then fix it.
I remember coming along to that high tea. I wonder if it was for the Peacock Summer when Lee Sales interviewed you.
Yes.
Somewhere in Sydney.
And yes, that was in Newtown, I think.
Yes, that's right. And one of the things that you talked about then, and something I've always remembered because I do it now, because you said that you do it and it works for you and it works for me as well, is when you're a little bit stuck, you go to the chapter or scene that you feel excited about writing. Do you still do that, or did you do that for this particular novel?
Yes, I still do that. Mm-hmm. For me, it's a way of getting unstuck.
Yes. Or
when I'm writing something, if it feels slow or boring, I know that it's probably going to feel slow or boring to a potential reader. I mean, I don't like to think too much about the reader because it can give you stage fright and actually stop you writing. But I recognize in myself if the story is feeling slow or I'm just not engaging with it in the way that I want to be. And there's always going to be sections of a book that sections that have to be told but aren't necessarily your favorite sections to write. But it's easier to go in and backfill those, I think, than it is to keep momentum. If you lose the momentum, that's really tricky. So to keep momentum going, I often will dart forward and write an exciting scene. Or I've just remembered in the book I'm writing at the moment, I sent a very rough draft to my sister and I'd skipped a scene that I just felt that I wasn't quite prepared to write. And I just filled in one line. It just said, exciting chase scene here, !! And she just sent it back to me with like lol next to that. So sometimes I skip the good bits as well, because I know that I'm not quite ready in my head to write that, or I haven't quite got the, you know, I'm not quite there. I think you've got to get to the scenes when you're ready, but sometimes you have to force yourself to just kind of write them as well, because otherwise you'd never finish a book. But I do like to jump around, and certainly the ending, that's my other big tip, is if you start to feel halfway through that you have lost track, but you know the ending. So I sometimes think writing the ending and having it sitting there is a really great marker to head towards. It's like the beacon in the distance guiding you forward. And so that's my other tip for when I need to remember it for myself, actually, when I get stuck, is to get the ending down.
Yeah,
makes it feel more like it's going to happen. It's going to be a complete thing.
And when you get that down, because I'm just thinking with the search party, there's a lot going on there. Do you just sort of paint in the foundations of it and a bit of dialogue and a bit of this, or is it really you just go hell for leather and that is like the full scene?
Yeah, I guess I kind of break it down. I think it's instinct, you know, like where's a good cliffhanger to end this scene, and then, you know, how do we break it with something else, and then how do we go back to it? And and so it's chopping it up in an interesting way and keeping the different characters in mind, in the reader's mind, so that, you know, you don't want to stay too long with one character. And also with the structure of this, it does go backwards and forwards a bit. So you kind of, it's about leaving the reader at a point where you've really teased them and then jumping back and then going forward again.
I can see how you did that. And that's why everybody has to read the book, so that they can see how you did that as well, because it makes perfect sense. And also towards the end, you do chop and change those characters quite quickly towards the end, because we're seeing from this character's point of view and this character's point of view, and you're just tearing through the pages because you do want to get into her head and his head and his head, and just to see where everybody is up to with this stuff that's happening. We're not doing spoilers because it's such a new book, but maybe one day we will have to come back, Hannah, and do a spoiler alert and tell everybody the secrets.
Well, I think the pace, I knew the pacing would be important. Mm. And actually, one of the things I worried about with the book was the pacing right in the front half of the book, because these sorts of books, you like to start with a bang. And then, you know, I enjoy reading those books where you know, you have short, sharp chapters and you can't turn those pages fast enough. And this book starts a little more slowly. And that was something that concerned me, you know, but actually I think it was like a train, you know, it's just getting faster and faster and faster. So as long as I can keep the readers with me at the beginning, then hopefully they get hooked by those characters and their stories to then find themselves in the chaos at the end.
Yes.
And hopefully the satisfying conclusion of that chaos.
Do you know who it reminded me of is Kate Atkinson, because she has these fantastic detailed characters. You get to know them in the first few chapters, and then this sort of plot just picks up and picks up and picks up, and then you're going hell for leather at the end between all the different points of view as the conclusion comes.
That's a massive compliment, because I think she's a genius writer. I love her work. So
yeah,
thank
same.
You. That's amazing.
It's a pleasure. So that brings us to a question from Fiona Taylor. She says, I'd love to know how much planning Hannah did before beginning the writing of The Search Party and whether this was a different process to her previous books.
The answer is not enough planning before I started writing. I think I sit somewhere between the plotter and the pantser, and I'm definitely not just a pantser. I don't just sort of start writing and see where it leads. I do need to have the thread of the idea to follow. But there's always that point where I sit back in my chair and go, why didn't you plot this more fully? You know, why didn't you have, I do hear about writers who have, you know, pages and pages of detailed notes about what each chapter is going to be. And then they sit down and they write. And I imagine that must be such a wonderful experience, just sit and write what you've got laid out. But for me, I think I would lose interest, and it might feel a bit like I was doing my homework if I knew too much about the story. And for me, the twists and the turns of the story often come through the writing. So in that sense, while I would love to do it the other way, I think I have to do it this way for me. First of all, to keep myself engaged and to be learning and curious about the story and where it's going. And secondly, just to see it through to the end. Otherwise, I think if I'd planned it to a great level of detail, it would almost feel like I'd already written it. And then I'd want to move on to the next idea. That's the problem. There's always a shiny new idea in the background, sort of trying to lure you away. So keeping with a book as you write it and not getting distracted or disheartened is for me one of the biggest challenges. So I think that process of discovery as I write is crucial for me to actually getting to write the end.
And it sounds like you overlaid a little bit of the planning after, like you said before, you got the characters down, and then you went and did the spreadsheet to sort of, okay, yes, now who have I got right? What's really going on here? Which is smart,
exactly.
I think.
So I got the characters down in the sense that I had divided them up into types. And so I knew that I would have the blended family with the helicopter parents, and kind of worked out the ages of the kids and very, very basic personality traits for those characters. And then I knew I would have the slightly more hippie free range family who were going to turn up in their combi van, and the kids were all going to, you know, be slightly more wild and free running. And, you know, they were going to turn up with their organic muesli and their homemade bread. And, you know, so it was thinking in types and stereotypes, really. Yeah. And then it was sort of diving into their world and exploring and discovering exactly who they were. And that was often when the backstory and bits and pieces like that come in.
Staying with the characters, you did such an incredible job of differentiating each of them. And I can see now that you've talked about it, how you did that. Apart from the teenager, Scarlett, and the child, Kip, so we have three men and three women, and they're are of a similar age and cultural and social background. You know, they all went to uni together. But as the reader, we're so aware of those differences, but they're also not cliched. So as we get to know them, you really give us layers. How did you develop those characters so that they weren't just sort of those initial 2D cardboard cutouts of characters?
Well, probably in the writing, when I first start writing, they are very two-dimensional and cardboard cutout. And so I always know as I'm writing, I need to go deeper. I need to show more. I need to show their emotion and their previous experiences and what's brought them to this point. And for me, again, that's about being curious about who they are and what they're bringing to this weekend and all the baggage that they've got, you know, emotionally behind them. So that's the fun part for me. My mum was a psychotherapist, and that's the other job I think I would have loved if I wasn't a writer, would be to talk to people and to find out, you know, what's going on in their lives and what they're living with. And so for me, each of these characters turns up on the weekend and they're living with something, and most of them have a secret. And so it was about learning about their secrets, figuring them out. And often it's just through playing. So take the character of Dominic, for example, who's kind of the alpha male of the group and very dominant within the weekend. He was very cardboard cut out and like a complete stereotype on the page. But the more time I spent with him and the more I dived back into his backstory and understood the things that happened to him on that he's chosen to do in his life, it just made me feel more connected to him. And, you know, it's like you're living with these people in your head. So they have to sort of start to feel real. Otherwise, they're not going to translate onto the page. I don't do those long sort of questionnaires, which I know you can do, where you drill down into each character and start to understand, you know, questions that you don't even really need to have answered in the book. It's just detail about them as human beings. I don't do that. I tend to just think more about them holistically as, you know, who are they, what age are they, and what are they bringing to this story, and where do we meet them, and then how are they then interacting with all the other people around them. So it's like going to a dinner party.
Yes.
And throwing a load of random people at a table and then seeing how they all get on, and then but you get to create the dinner party and you get to create the characters that are sitting there. So, I mean, it's such a fun job, really, when you think about it.
How much of a part does dialogue play for you when you're getting those characters out on the page? Is that something that helps you to differentiate them as well, the way they speak and the inner monologues, whatever's happening for them?
Yeah, I'd say the inner monologue more so than the dialogue for me. I don't know why. I know some people really love writing the dialogue and that's how they bring out their characters. I think I do it differently. I think I'm more sort of the internal voice for the character. But where I knew that I needed to be very clear on the dialogue was the differentiation between the adults and the kids. So I've got sections where the kids are all hanging out together and you've got teenagers and, you know, you've got a 6-year-old in the group and you've got a 12-year-old. And so I needed to make sure that the voices felt different at different stages. And actually, I have listened to the audiobook of this. I don't normally listen to my audios, but I have listened to this audio. And I think the two actors that read the male and the female characters do a really great job of distinguishing, first of all, between the men and the women, but also between the adults and the children, which cannot be easy to do.
Such a talent.
Yes, such a talent. Yeah, I don't think I'd be able to do that. You have to be a proper actor or actress to be able to do that. So yeah, I hear their voices in my head, but I think I focus more on the inner voice for the characters to draw out their personalities.
But the kids, they were so well done too. I mean, I think anyone who's writing children should read these sections, because I could picture those kids. I mean, you have kids and you spend a lot of time around kids, but it's just the different ways that they all interact, and there's always one that's a bit too cool for school and one who's the really active energizer bunny and one that's a little bit more, no, you know, let's not do that. That's, you know, let's not do the wrong thing. There's always sort of the goody two shoes. And I feel like you just captured them all so well.
Oh, well, thank you. I think I have my beautiful blended family to thank for that because I've got two kids of my own, and I have three gorgeous stepchildren now as well. And they range in age from 19 to 13. And so being surrounded by kids of varying ages is very eye-opening. And those car journeys when they're in the car and they sort of lose their self-consciousness and just start talking, and you get to sort of see those glimmers of their true selves is always quite fascinating. So, but also, I mean, you know, it's a universal experience, isn't it? Being a child and being a teenager, and, you know, you can take yourself back to that place too and remember what it was like. And I was probably more the willow of the group, a bit more goody two shoes and nervous about doing the wrong thing and not wanting to get into trouble. So yeah,
that was me too.
Yeah. So I was like, oh yeah, I get willow. Whereas Scarlett's more stroppy and angry about life. So yeah, she was quite fun to write.
Probably with good reason, but yes, we'll let people read the novel to figure out why. So the story is told not only through eight points of view, but in a dual timeline. So tell me about that choice and how that played out during the writing and the editing, because I can imagine that was just another layer of complexity for you.
Yeah, so structurally, the book slips backwards and forwards. So you've got the present day police investigation, which is happening after the weekend that's just taken place, and the police are grilling the characters about what's happened and trying to work out who's to blame. And then as the police interview the main characters of this book, they slide back to take the reader through the weekend that's just happened. So then you go back, you start on Friday afternoon with everyone driving and arriving at this campsite in Cornwall. And then their memories gradually shift forward through the weekend, and you get the Saturday and the Sunday unfolding and the sort of aftermath of what's happened. So you've got the present day police narrative. You've also got the weekend, but then there's another layer as well, yes, which is the backstories of the characters, which I think you need to understand who these people are and what's brought them to this place and this big mess that they're living through. So there were sort of three points, really: the sort of immediate present, the recent past, and then the further distant past. And really, it wasn't that tricky to write once I figured out that the police were part of the story and that their investigation was going to be the way back into the weekend. I think I mentioned at the beginning of our chat that I first of all started writing it in a more straightforward way. So it was the weekend unfolding from Friday through to Sunday, but that just didn't feel intriguing enough. And so once the three different time frames came to mind and I was clear on them, it then felt quite natural to weave them together. And I think it was almost like my previous novels, which are often dual timeline, or playing around with past, present, and flipping between the two. I think that was great practice, actually, for then pulling this novel off and its existing format. So interesting, the book I've just finished writing is more of a linear timeline, which is not something I've written before. So that was quite interesting because that was like, you know, learning a new style, really.
You do love a challenge, Hannah.
Yes. Well, I think I'm keeping myself interested as much as anything. You know, I don't want to write the same book each time. You know, as I said, I love a book that feels like a puzzle. And so for me, it's almost like I'm challenging myself with each novel to create and solve a puzzle, which is fun.
Yeah. The other clever part about including the police investigation in the present time frame was that it provided a perfect vehicle for learning about the characters and how they all knew each other, because the police could say, and how did you all meet? And one of the characters, I think it's Dom in that first chapter of Dom's, says, well, we all met at university and blah, blah, blah. So you kind of, for each of the characters as they get brought into the interview room, are also able to shed a bit more light on the characters' backstories, both as a group and as individually and as families. So that was, I loved that. I thought that was, like, looking back, I went, oh, I see what she did there.
Yeah, they were quite a good device. I did have to make sure, one of my publisher's comments when they were editing the book was, you know, can you make those characters feel a little bit more real, like the police characters, because you don't want them to feel like they're just there to serve the function of laying out the groundwork. So, I mean, that was good feedback and something that I needed to work on. And but they're not central characters, so that, you know, you don't want to go too far into that and distract from the main story. But they were very helpful, definitely, at seeding in bits of information that the reader needed to know, or leading the story where I wanted to take it. So maybe I need two curious police officers in every book I write from now on, just to guide everybody through.
But it's also lovely having police officers who are also not those cardboard cutout police officers, you know, that they actually do have a bit of EQ and they do understand what these characters are going through and they're trying to help.
Yeah, the family liaison officer who's at the farmhouse with the characters in the aftermath, I kind of wanted to feel a bit softer and, you know, a bit more with the characters. But at the same time, she's a police officer and she's quite suspicious about what's gone on. So there's an edge, which again, you know, the edge provides the tension and, you know, what have they all done and who's covering up what and, you know, what on earth has gone on this weekend.
Was there a point at which you said, okay, what are all the questions that need to be answered? And have I answered them? You know, who died? Why did they die? Who was responsible? Who is in the hospital? Like, these are all the questions I as a reader had. But did you at one point go, have I answered all these damn questions that I've thrown up for these characters?
Probably not, because by the end of writing a draft, I cannot see it clearly at all.
It's so hard, isn't it?
Yeah. So I probably didn't. Even if I had asked myself those questions, I don't even know if I would have had the answers. And that's where a wonderful beta reader or editors comes in, because you need fresh eyes. You need someone to go through it, comb through it really, and just say, oh, I didn't quite understand this. And I don't think that character would have said that. Or, you know, what happened to X, you know, that just never gets answered. So that's where the reader comes in. And for me, it's always my sister. She always steps in and offers to read the first draft, which is very generous of her, because first drafts are always messy and not very fulfilling. She's got eagle eyes and she just pours through things and points out where I've messed up. And so I think I'm too close to it at that point to be able to answer all the questions. I also like to have a little bit of ambiguity for a couple of the characters so that the reader can decide, you know, what they think their path will be from that point onwards. So there's probably two characters where you don't really know what's going to happen. So I kind of like to play with the making sure it's satisfying, but also leaving a tiny chink of, you know, the door slightly open.
You touched on backstory before, and that's always one of the things that most impresses me with your writing from a craft perspective, Hannah, is your very deft handling of backstory and flashbacks. I would like to know all of your backstory secrets. What's the secret to weaving it in? Because I struggle with that, but you handle it really well. Do you have anything, any techniques that you tend to fall back on, or does it just flow quite easily for you?
Well, interestingly, I struggle with it too. I don't find it an easy process to...
You'd never know.
Well, that's great to hear, because... Sometimes, I mean, we're all our own worst critic, I'm sure, but sometimes when I read things back, I want it, in an ideal world, backstory feels seamless, right? Mm. You just kind of slide into it. You kind of don't even know that you've gone back there. You just feel like you're with the character and they're telling you an important piece of their past, really, a scene from their past. And you don't feel like you've been taken out of the present day story. So in an ideal world, that's what happens. Sometimes when I read my own work back, and maybe before it, you know, particularly with an editor, that's where I have to do a lot of work to kind of really try and make it feel effortless. It's not an easy thing to do, but I tend to do it. I'm sure everyone's got different techniques. I've noticed that I often slide into backstory through memory. So it's often when a character's feeling introspective, they're having a moment. And I think it fits with the idea of pacing as well, because you can't have a book that's just constantly like bam, 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 because first of all, you can't get the backstory in that builds your characters. And secondly, it's too relentless And you need to be able to breathe and take a breath as you're reading, you know, a very adrenaline-fueled story. So actually, I think it works with pace to have those moments of reflection where a character slips back into memory and tells the reader, shows the reader something from their past that illuminates the present-day moment and who they are. So I think a couple of examples. I know Kira has a moment of reflection in the tent in the middle of the storm where she is remembering an experience she had with one of the characters, which is her sort of big secret. And that felt like the right moment to do it because the character has just burst into the tent and they've had a confrontation and then he's left. So she's left sitting there kind of shell-shocked in the middle of the storm. And so it felt natural that her memory would go back to the moment that had caused that scene. And so it kind of happens effortlessly if the story is slotting together right. And it provides those moments of quiet stillness that then, you know, allow you to then jump into the next big sort of dramatic point where the tension ramps up again. And there's another moment, I think, with Kip where he's on a group expedition with the kids. And they're heading off to a beach. And it felt really natural at that point just to slide into Kip's head because we're with him already in that chapter and to reveal a little bit more of his backstory, which he's an adopted child who's had a pretty traumatic childhood up to the point that he's adopted. And yeah, I wanted the reader to be able to understand who he was as a little boy or to get a glimpse, really. Like, you don't want to go too heavy-handed with it because it does jar and break the flow of the story. But at the same time, if you're going to care about these characters, you need to understand a little bit about them and where they've been.
I think you want to understand by that stage as well. I was ready to learn about Kip's story. And I was ready to hear about the confrontation, you know, the initial, I can't name names, but Kira's memory. I was ready to hear that story as well. You're gasping for it almost at that point.
And if you drip feed in enough clues, then you're getting to a point as a reader where you're like, well, just tell me already.
Yes, please, for the love of God, tell me.
Yes. So, you have to time it right.
Yeah. But even... I mean, I'm looking on page 29 here and I'm in Max. So Max and Annie are the couple who've started the glamping business. Annie's just a bit worried about how the weekend's going to go off. And he then says to himself in his mind, it was frustrating to witness her anxiety. He wanted to remind her of all those nights they'd lain awake in their London house, listening to neighbours and sirens, worrying about Kip's struggles at school, about their demanding clients, the plans and permits, escalating building costs. He wanted to remind her of the awful creeping exhaustion that had begun to suffocate them both, the dawning realisation that their life in London, the one they'd worked so hard to create, was no longer the one they wanted. And just with that paragraph, you've just given us so much in the first couple of chapters of the book. So get a real sense of, right, that's where they've come from. Now, where are they? And I thought that was, you did that with all of the characters in those opening few chapters. And I just felt I had enough to go on until later in the book when I got the big reveals.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad that worked.
Hannah, is there a part of the novel that you think illustrates some of these points that you could read?
I was thinking I could read the section where Kip slides back into his memory, which does reveal quite a lot about his character. So if you haven't read the book, then it tells you who the boy is, really, more than anything. But I thought I could read that as an example of how I take him back to show his past experience to the reader. So the scene actually starts with the kids. It's Saturday afternoon and they've decided to head off on their own to the beach, which, as any sensible parent would know, probably isn't the greatest idea. And so the kids are all, they're various personalities. They're on this beach. The weather's sort of shifting around them and they're kind of losing themselves in this wild landscape and they're forgetting themselves basically for a short time. Wandering towards the girls, Kip's eye was caught by something glinting silver at the edge of a sandy pool. He crouched and saw it was a knife, its stout wooden handle caught in a tangle of weed, the metal blade flat and corroded with age. It looked like a shucking knife, The kind he'd seen fishmongers using on oyster shells and scallops at the harbourside market Max sometimes took him to. He lifted it and brushed the sand from the handle. It felt good in his hands, sturdy yet light. He swiped it through the air a couple of times, then tested the blade against the pad of his thumb. Kip knew you could sharpen dull blades, but he wasn't sure about rust. Maybe he could polish it up, make it like new again, make it his. The weight of it in his hand reminded him of what it had felt like to wield Max's penknife, the control he'd felt whittling the willow sticks, the importance he'd felt to be entrusted with Max's special tool, and the praise he'd received for a job well done, until Phoebe had stolen his marshmallow and ruined everything. In his old house, the one with the green swirling carpet and the sagging red sofa that smelled of cigarettes, and worse, the house he'd lived in with his other parents, the ones he didn't see anymore, you didn't get treats like biscuits or marshmallows. You didn't get very much of anything. There were no trips to the supermarket to fill a big trolley, no plasters for scratches or grazes, no kisses for cuts and bruises, no piles of clean folded laundry, no books on shelves, no warm radiators or well-fitting shoes, no one reminding you to go to school. Meals were infrequent, forgotten, sometimes for days. Left alone at home, Kip would scavenge through cupboards for forgotten traces of food, the dregs in a cereal box, the end of a loaf of bread, crumbled crackers, a wrinkled apple at the bottom of the fridge. When the milk ran out, the baby would scream and scream until she didn't. I'm going to stop there because I could keep going, but there's a lot of detail in there for Kip and what he's been through, which is there to illustrate to the reader, first of all, what a traumatic start in life he's had. And it's there to raise questions in the reader's mind, really, as they read through the book. You know, who is this kid and what is his story? And some of the characters in the book know his story, some of them don't, but a lot of them are left in the book questioning what he might be capable of. So it's quite an important scene in that it kind of raises some questions in the reader's mind as well.
It's also, I think, a perfect snapshot of his life before Max and Annie and with Max and Annie. So it provides that contrast of his two lives.
Yeah, the things that he's noticing he didn't have versus the things he's noticing he does have. You know, even just things like going to supermarket and filling a shopping trolley, which for a kid like Kip is a new experience. I just wanted to really show how he's moved from one life experience into another and how difficult that might be for him.
It's also, as far as this novel goes, it's a fantastic point of tension because we don't know what he's capable of. So there's that element of that unreliable narrator, you know, is he or isn't he capable of doing this thing?
Yes.
I've got a question, actually two questions from Gemma, one of our listeners. Her Instagram handle is Reading for Keep. So Gemma asked, I'm curious about the editing process. What does this involve for Hannah? So I know your sister is your first reader.
Yes.
What happens when what does she send you back? Is she brutally honest with you?
So my first drafts are messy and often have questions that still need to be answered. But generally, the way I write is I kind of comb backwards and forwards through scenes as I'm writing. So I have been told by editors that my first drafts that I hand into a publisher are quite polished in terms of, you know, spelling mistakes and things being in the right place. What I did do with this novel, because I wrote it out of contract, so I didn't have a publisher lined up, and I was feeling quite nervous and about, you know, whether it would find a place, you know, whether anyone would want to read it. I invested in a freelance editor, a woman called Anna Barrett, she actually works in Singapore, but she's been in the industry for a long time. She was recommended to me, and I hired her to look at the manuscript before I even sent it to my agent, because I really wanted it to be good. And I wanted my agent to think, wow, you know, she's pulled it off. And Anna read through it, and fortunately, she thought it was in a really good state. So that was really helpful. But she had a really great piece of advice about one of the characters' secrets, which was Kira's. And she pointed out that all the reveals were coming in the final third of the book. And actually, it would be more compelling and interesting to bring one of those reveals earlier so to the reader, not necessarily to the characters, but so yes. that the reader knew what was going on. And that was really good advice. And that was, it involved a little bit of unpicking, but once I'd done that, I could see that it created more impetus in the first half of the book. And also it wasn't treating the reader like a dummy, because they would have figured it out, I think, anyway. So it's just like, yeah, we know what's coming. So actually to bring it forward was a really smart piece of advice. So I did do that in my own editing process. I sent it to my agent. There wasn't very much feedback from her. So then it went straight out to publishers. Once a publisher had offered on it, I had a slightly tricky editorial process where I was in the fortunate position of Simon & Schuster in Canada, America, Australia, and the UK all buying the book.
Oh, Hannah, that's so exciting.
It was amazing. But they all sent editorial feedback.
Oh, my gosh.
So I had to balance the editorial tweaks and make sure, fortunately, I think they'd all spoken to each other. So there wasn't anything massively conflicting in there. But it was a long process of working through different sets of notes and making sure I had done as much as I could from what everyone was suggesting, while still holding on to the things that I felt strongly about. But structurally, there really wasn't that much to edit. So it then became more about, you know, can you enhance this character slightly? Or we want to know more about this. You haven't answered this question, to go back to your earlier point. So yeah, that's when editors stepped in. But I actually really enjoy the editing process. I think writing the first draft is quite painful sometimes, and it's hard to maintain that curiosity and joy that you want to bring to the experience. But editing feels like, okay, we've got this down. Now it's just a case of polishing. And for me, I quite like that stage. It's fulfilling and I enjoy it. So
Gemma's other question, and I was curious about this as well, is about prologues. You know, the should we or shouldn't we not have a prologue? And I know you do like a prologue. What do you think, Hannah? Do you think prologues are more suited to this type of novel as opposed to, well, Gemma's saying as opposed to rom-coms, but I guess as opposed to any other kind of novel?
Yeah, that's a good question from Gemma. The job I see prologues doing is, it's a teaser, right? It's a kind of way of showing a small hint of what's to come. And I have tried to write books without prologues. And when I have tried to omit the prologue, I've actually been asked to put the prologue in by a publisher. So the whole idea that publishers hate prologues, I think, is rubbish. It's just got to be the right prologue or a good prologue and be doing a job. Mm. If it's not doing a job, then it doesn't need to be there. And you can go straight into chapter one and throw the reader straight in. I think with a rom-com, there's no reason why you couldn't have a prologue if it's teasing or hinting or adding a little bit of tension to what is about to come. But they have to serve a purpose. I think if it's just a beautiful piece of writing that the writer can't let go of or wants to kind of show off their skill, that's when they become redundant. And that's where you have to be a little careful. But if it's serving a purpose, I say go for it. I love a prologue. And I was trying to write my new book without a prologue. And then annoyingly, my sister, when she read the draft, she was like, what about if you started with? And she gave me this little idea and it was so good. I thought, yeah, I've got to put the prologue in.
Now, I have a question. I heard you talking about your self-imposed writing retreats. I think maybe I've seen that on Instagram or something like that. Did you have one of your self-imposed writing retreats for this novel?
Well, I did go away for this one. I find I have to retreat at the right time in the writing process. So I wouldn't want to do it at the very beginning of writing a novel, because I don't think I'm far enough in to get the most out of it. But it's at the point usually where I feel like I can't live with all the threads of the story in my head and all the threads of my real life happening around me. It's too much. I almost feel like I'm going to explode. And at that point, I recognize that I need to escape from my everyday real life and my poor kids and my husband and the dog. And I just need to lock myself away and immerse myself, you know, eat, sleep, breathe the writing and dream the writing and just immerse myself in it so that I can wake up at 5 a.m. and start writing and still be writing at 11 o'clock at night if I want to be, or I could just be lying in bed reading a great book and getting ready for the next day of writing. this book, I took myself off on an Arvon retreat. So in the UK here, there's a really wonderful organization called Arvon, and they do loads of great writing programs, but they also offer untutored retreats where you go, you have a room with a desk, they provide all the food. So you can go down to the kitchen and make yourself meals, or, you know, it's nice food. There's no cook. So you literally kind of, yeah, it is heaven, because the other great thing about it is that there are other writers there retreating. So you don't have to engage. You can be very aloof and do your own thing and lock yourself away. Or if at the end of a day's writing, you want to sit down in the kitchen with a cup of tea and talk to somebody, there's usually someone kicking around. And I got really lucky on this one. There were only three of us booked onto the retreat. And there was a comedy improv writer called Katie and a playwright called Amy. And the three of us turned up on the first day. And we all realized within the space of about 5 minutes that we had a friend in common, and a wonderful woman called Ruth, who I went to university with and lived with at university. And they just happened to know her from, she's an actress and she worked in the improv world, and she knows Amy through theater stuff. It was so bizarre. But that instant connection meant that the three of us got on like a house on fire. And so in the evenings we would meet and we'd talk about what we were working on and just have a laugh. And it was a really productive 5 days. And that really helped me smash through the complications of the plot, and, you know, some of the character problems I was having at the time. And so, yeah, for me, I highly recommend writing retreats if you can find the time to do it. And sometimes the money as well. Unfortunately, they do cost money if you do something like Arvon. But I find it a really valuable investment because it helps get me over the line often with a book. And it seems to be the only way I can really push through to the end.
Yeah, where nobody's asking if their uniform has been ironed, or you don't have to hop in the car, or, yeah, what's for dinner tonight? Oh, what's for dinner? Oh, that question, please. That should be banned for all writers.
It feels like such a luxury. And I'm starting to try and tell myself, I now see the benefit from them. I'm telling myself it's part of the job, that I actually need to do it.
I think you're right. It is part of the job, Hannah.
Yeah.
Everybody needs to beg, borrow, or steal a holiday house or something, just get away.
It's hard though, isn't it? And I think particularly for women, we find it very hard to put aside all the commitments of our lives, whether it's our parents or our children or our jobs or, you know, all the things going on around us. And that awful guilt sinks in when we start to prioritize the things that are just for us. And I'm trying to manage that now and just say, this is my job. You know, I am allowed to take this time. And it helps now my kids are a little older too. And I have a lovely partner and a wonderful mum who can step in. So that helps.
That does make a difference to have that
support. It really does. Yeah, it really does.
And the kids being older, I mean, you know, if they can get themselves off to school in the morning, that's just streets ahead of where they are when they're in primary school. It's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
It does get easier, everybody.
It does, yeah. So anyone out there who's struggling to carve out that time, first of all, I'd say do it, because it's not selfish. And secondly, you know, if you're struggling to do it, it does get easier.
Yeah, you said before that sometimes you just hop into bed with a book on a retreat if you've got your writing done for the day. Can you read while you're writing, or do you find that it infiltrates?
I like to keep reading, actually. Mm. Sometimes I'll avoid the genre that I'm writing in for fear of, you know, accidentally picking something up.
Yeah.
So I might switch to nonfiction or memoir or just poetry, even sometimes just picking up a poetry book at the end of a writing day and seeing how someone's laced together some beautiful words to make something can be as inspiring. And I actually on retreat I do like to immerse myself with words. So often I'll have, by the end of Arvon, I think I had stacks of books that I just pulled off the bookshelves there, and they were just sitting next to the desk, and some of them I hadn't even looked at. But it's almost like having sort of these, what's the word I'm thinking of, you know, like
sort of like talisman or just,
yes,
yeah,
lucky charms, you know.
Yeah, lucky charms, yeah, you can just dip in and dip out.
It's like having a little cheer squad of other writers around you going,
yes,
go for it.
I know. Sometimes you could pick up a Kate Atkinson novel and just read, just open it up to any page and just read a paragraph and go, oh, that's the tone. That's the tone.
Yes. Yeah. Or even just what a beautiful piece of writing, which in its own way is inspiring and makes you want to try harder in your own work, you know, and particularly the genre that I write in at the moment, it's very plot driven. So actually it's great for me to, you know, I love to read Robert McFarlane, who writes beautifully about landscape. And I find that then helps me reset almost and then think, okay, no, I need to conjure the landscape here for the readers. So how am I going to describe this Cornish cliff? And, you know, it doesn't have to be a great long Robert McFarlane style paragraph of writing, but it just reminds me about the details that I want to focus on.
Yeah.
And so I think it's inspiring whatever genre you're reading, and actually to read widely across different genres can be just as inspiring and helpful as just focusing on one genre.
Yeah, I agree. I was reading something the other day and it reminded me that I didn't really have any smells in my novel. And then that reminded me of listening to, I think it was Peter Fitzsimons talking about his writing, and he said, you know, I always tell my researchers I need the sights, the smells, the sounds. And I'm like, yes, the sounds, the smells, what are they seeing? What are they smelling? Yeah. What are they hearing? You know, and sometimes you just need that reminder. That's the extra layer I need to put into this scene or whatever it might be, just to add the depth that it needs.
You're making me wonder whether I've put smell in the search party. it's interesting, isn't it? But yeah, those are the sorts of things that we should be asking ourselves as writers. You know, how have I created the atmosphere and taken the reader into this place? And now I'm thinking smell, right? Need to put more smells in my book.
And Hannah's next novel will contain lots of things.
A lot of fragrance.
Baking bread. Hannah, thank you so much for taking the time with me this morning for you, this evening for me. I'm so happy that you came on and we've had this chat. It's just been delightful.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. I know we weren't recording when I said this at the beginning, but I absolutely love this podcast, Michelle, and it is my treat when I'm walking my dog in the morning around the English countryside to put my earphones on and listen to you talking to different writers about their skills and their techniques and the way they've conjured their books. It's just, I love it. It's like the way I start my day before I sit down at my desk. So thank you for all the amazing podcasts that you're giving us.
Oh, that's so lovely. Coming from you, that's a huge compliment. Thank you, Hannah. Now, before we wrap up, the Ritual Prize is about to open, isn't it? April, it normally opens?
April the 22nd, it opens.
For anyone who doesn't know about the Ritual Prize, tell us.
So the Ritual Prize is 10 years old this year. So it's the big
exciting
anniversary year. And it's a prize that was started... inspired by really my late husband, Matt Ritchell, who died in a surfing accident in 2014. And at the time he was CEO of Hachette Australia. And so there was this sort of terrible personal tragedy for me and the kids and Matt's family and friends, for the man that we'd lost, but also from a work point of view, he'd recently taken the reins of Hachette and he had all these incredible plans to, you know, really support emerging Australian writers and develop the Australian literary scene, which was his passion. So the prize was started in conjunction with Simpson Solicitors, Hachette Australia and the Emerging Writers Festival. And it's there to support unpublished writers of fiction and nonfiction. It's free to enter. You only have to supply three chapters and a synopsis and a statement letting the judges know what winning the prize, why the winning the prize would help you. And you would win, if you win, a mentorship, a year's mentorship with a Hachette publisher who is there to help steer your work in whatever way you want to work with them. And you also win $10,000 prize money, which is there to hopefully give you the time and the support that you need to finish the work that you're writing. So it's a very wide ranging prize in that we're not open to children's writing, but if it's memoir, fiction, crime fiction, commercial fiction, literary fiction, non-fiction, you know, it could be anything, short stories. And in fact, we've had winners across the board, really, yes, across all different genres. So I think it's a really inspiring and hopeful thing. And I hope, even for the writers that don't win the prize, I hope it's a kind of chance to sort of really focus on the work and that they want to do, and a chance to get their work read, get a bit of feedback if you get shortlisted. And we've had quite a lot of books go on to be published. So
yes,
for me personally, it's a really lovely moment each year to be involved and to see Matt's legacy kind of continue in this way. Yes. But I hope for writers that are sort of looking and finding the publishing world really confounding and hard to break into, I hope it's just another channel in, and that people find it's a way to elevate their work practice.
And
you were one of our highly commendeds, weren't you, Michelle, in 2017?
2017,
yeah.
Which feels like it should just be last year, but is actually, 6 years ago? 7 years ago coming up this year.
Yeah. No, I still remember.
I've had a fantastic year with Robert Watkins as my mentor. Not yet published, that book. I have not given up on it. It is still sitting there. It needs a rewrite, probably knowing what I know now, actually. And it possibly wasn't the right time for that novel back in 2017 or 2018, which is by the time it was finished.
Yeah.
So I will go back to it. Jo Riccioni is a really good friend of mine, and she offered to read through it again, which she did last year. And she had these just fresh eyes. And she said, I think I know the thing you need to do. So she gave me 3 pages of notes, which I just put aside with the novel. It's sort of in the metaphorical drawer,
yes,
while I finish this second one. And I will go back to it.
That's exciting, because it stayed with me, Michelle. I remember it very clearly, which I think is a good sign, because a lot, you know, you don't remember. And that's why you were highly commended on the shortlist that year. So I definitely think you should go back to it when you feel ready. But I'm really pleased to hear you're writing the second novel as well. That's really exciting.
Thank you. But I would urge anybody who has even just your 3 chapters, and that's the beauty of the Ritual Prize, you only need the 3 chapters. You don't need that finished manuscript. Enter, because it can change your life. I mean, I got an agent from it. I met so many wonderful people, including yourself. And it can just make all the difference. And the discipline of entering the prize and polishing those 3 chapters and, you know, even just writing that synopsis, that's such a skill. So you might not have ever done that before, but honing that as part of the entry, such a great skill, and that will stay with you as well. So do enter. Keep an eye on the Hachette website, the Emerging Writers website, socials, and just get your entries in, people.
Yeah. And also, someone made a really good point the other day, actually, that I saw. They said, you know, it opens on April the 22nd, but it doesn't close till July. So you don't have to enter on April the 22nd. You don't have to submit your work then. You've got time. And actually, it is worth sitting with your work, you know, polishing it, then putting it away, and then coming back to it with fresh eyes, because it's amazing what you spot on the second, third, fourth rereading. So you don't have to get it in on April the 22nd. There's plenty of time. That's you could even write 3 chapters from now and send them in. So you've got nothing to lose. As I say, you don't have to pay to enter. So we would encourage any serious writers who would like to be published to send their work in.
Yeah. And there's no better feeling than seeing your name on a long list and then a short list. It's just brilliant. And like you say, having those little wins along the way of your author journey, and it is full of ups and downs, isn't it, Hannah? You've got publisher, and then you're out of contract, and then you get another publisher, and it's like the highs, the lows, and, you know, entering prizes is one of the ways that you can give yourself a little win along the way, even if you just end up on the long list and that's as far as it goes.
Interestingly, that's what my late husband used to say to me when I started writing. And when I first got a publishing deal, he would say, it's so important to celebrate every small win along the way, because he recognized, you know, that it was a a difficult career path, you know, and there are ups and downs and moments where you really doubt yourself. So actually every small win is, you know, potentially a big win and something to hold on to. So yeah, he used to say that. So I'm glad you said that too. That's really nice.
Well, I can't think of a better way to end than with a sentiment from Matt. So thank you, Hannah, so much for today. It's been such a delight and I look forward to reading the next book.
Thank you, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
There you go, Hannah Richell. I hope you loved that chat as much as I did. So good. I could have actually kept on chatting for another hour to Hannah. In fact, we did keep chatting for a while. I also want to say a huge thank you to Penelope Janu, Fiona Taylor, and Gemma from Reading for Keeps for your wonderful questions today. I've popped links to all of those writers in the show notes. You can find Hannah's website at hannahritchell.com, and all the links from today's show, including where to buy Hannah's books and her website, are in the show notes. So go and check those out right here in your podcast app. So just scroll down and you'll find them. You'll also find all the show notes at writersbookclubpodcast.com. And of course, that's where you'll also find the whole backlist, every single episode. So many great authors, so much excellent writing craft advice. So make sure you go and check that out. If you're enjoying the podcast, head on over to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen, and you can quickly tap out a rating or you can leave a review, which I would absolutely love. Now, I'm having a little break from the podcast in April for two reasons. Firstly, to get some writing done and try and finish this new novel, the one I was telling Hannah about. And secondly, in very exciting news, I'm building a new course. As many of you know, I'm a website designer in my day job, specializing in author websites. Funny about that. You can have a look at some of the websites I've done over on my website, which is at freshwebdesign.com.au, if you're curious. Now, to have me build a website for you starts at around $4,000, which, you know, isn't exactly spare change down the back of the couch. So the course I'm creating will be a much more affordable option. It's called Build an Author Website, and it's exactly like it says on the tin. At the end of the course, you will have built your very own beautiful, fully functional website in Squarespace. I will take you step by step through the whole process, from selecting the right domain, what to put on your homepage and your book page and your about page and your blog if you want one, and so on. There'll be a module there to help you set up an online store if you're selling your own books or if you're even selling services like editing or mentoring. And we'll get your mailing list set up because that's really important. We'll connect all of your socials, hook you up with Google Search Console, get your SEO sorted. And of course, I'll show you how to create your own branding. So your colors, your fonts, logo if you want one, all the fun stuff. We're going to go through and figure out your particular style for the website, whether that be minimalist and moody for the crime writers, or whimsical and pretty for the romance writers, or perhaps you'll go for something rustic or vintage or luxe. There'll be a style that suits either the genre you write in or your own personal taste. You know, we can base it on a favorite color or a favorite font. Or one of the things I love to do is base it on your headshots. And of course, we're going to be talking about headshots as well. I've also created a couple of website templates that are ready to go for you to customize, along with some social media templates and 30 days of social media prompts. Basically, I'm aiming to pack in as much value as possible for you so that you can create an author website and a platform that you're really proud to show off to everyone. And so basically, so you can hit the ground running. So if you'd like to be notified when the course enrollment goes live, you can pop your name on my list, which you can find at freshwebdesign.com.au/course. Now, that doesn't commit you to anything, but everybody on that list will get first access to the early bird discount that I'll be offering. I'll also be running a free author website workshop before the course goes live, so you'll get first access to that as well. I mean, you might already have a website, but maybe it feels a little bit tired and you just want to jush it up a bit. So that free workshop will be perfect for you because you'll get loads of new ideas to inspire you to give your website a bit of a makeover. I mean, we can all use a little makeover every now and then, let's face it. So that link again is freshwebdesign.com.au/course, and I'll pop the link in the show notes too. Okay, lovely people, that's it for this month. I'm recording on the beautiful unceded lands of the Garigal people of the Eora Nation, where I'm lucky enough to live and work. Wishing you all a very productive couple of months, and I'll see you again in May. Take care.